You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
We'll start with our motivation. I clicked on the news headlines a short while ago and saw that Prince has died suddenly. Recording star of the 80s, 90s, 2000s, 57 years old. I just read the first paragraph, but I didn't know why yet. But especially, I think, when an icon like that goes quickly, it's such a teaching for us. That there are close people who will be mourning him. There will be fans all over the world who are doing tributes. Even President Obama has issued a statement or an appreciation for him. And yet, he was born, aged, sick, died. Birth, aging, sickness, death. And there will be people who are close to him, when they miss his presence, they will wonder, where did he go? They will suffer, they will be sad. And here we are, our lives passing moment by moment, by moment, by moment, by moment, by moment, not standing still for a second. From the moment of our conception, our death is definite. Is there a person that actually comes from somewhere? When we die, is there a person that goes somewhere? And the sentient beings, because we don't know how to answer that question correctly, we are constantly grabbing at things as permanent, as in the nature of happiness, as having some true existence from their own side, especially ourselves, and as the body in aggregates being pure. And so much suffering comes from this. And the confusion brings so much pain, and we are born, we live, we die, we're born, we live, we die, we're born, we live, we die. Everybody around us has the same experience, propelled by our karma. Karma is created on the basis of our afflictions. Our afflictions arise on the basis of our ignorance. And we suffer needlessly. It's true for us. It's true for all the beings around us whose kindness we rely on and have always. And so, as we think about this tonight and as we look at Nagarjuna's amazing text, rejoicing that we have an opportunity to actually question, where do we come from and where do we go? What does that mean to think that we go somewhere, we abide somewhere, we come from somewhere? What's the real nature of our existence? How is it that we really exist? And to set our heart on taking the opportunity while we have it, while we still are breathing, which could change also at any moment, to really put our minds to wishing to free every single being from this confusion, from the state of needless suffering, by sharpening our own wisdom, cultivating our understanding of the nature of reality, and cultivating our bodhicitta so that we do not leave out a single being in our aspiration to liberate all of us, Prince included, from the cycle of birth, aging, and death. Which is our potential? That freedom. Our full awakening. So may we do it together. And may we create the causes tonight as we do this to that leads inexorably to that result. So, as you can see, Venerable Children is still on the road. She's in outside of Hamburg this weekend, giving a retreat at Samkeling. I think it's Samkeling is the name of the place, associated with Tibetan Center Hamburg. And so we are continuing with our review of Precious Garland. We're still in Chapter 1. And tonight, my aspiration is to get through questions 7 through 12. This will be a participatory event, I hope. I have a lot of pages here in case it's not, but I think we don't want to hear me read all these pages. I think better we have some exchange. So I want to review and go back to the foundation of the questions that we're looking at tonight. The first one goes back to our review a couple of weeks ago. These few questions are all kind of fitting within how the view fits within the two extremes. So what are the two extremes?
Absolutism and nihilism.
Absolutism and nihilism. And what does that mean? Thinking there's no moral consequences to an action would be which one?
Nihilism.
Any other thoughts on that one? Let me get us really precise. Cutting through appearances. And this is Geshe Sopa and Jeffrey commenting on the text. It says, to hold an extreme of permanence, absolutism, is to superimpose existence on what actually does not exist. Superimpose existence on what actually does not exist, as in holding that a unitary independent self exists. That's an example. To hold an extreme of annihilation is to deny the existence of something that actually does exist, as in holding that there is no liberation from cyclic existence. And then they go on to say, the Prasangika Madhyamaka has maintained that all lower tenets fall to the extreme of permanence. Yet all the lower tenet schools maintain that their systems have the middle way between the two extremes, and they all have different explanations for how they do that. And of course they all, he doesn't say this here, but they all accuse the Prasangikas of being nihilist, and that's where we'll come into tonight. So the next kind of basis that I want to just review from last week, Venerable Jigme had some great stuff on this, but Stephen gave me a paragraph on fabricated conceptuality, from how to see yourself as you really are, that I think sums it all up. So this is a book by His Holiness. So again, this is one of the bases of one of the things that we're looking at this week. So fabricated conceptuality from His Holiness's point of view. It seems to me, in the end, the meaning of the worlds being established by conceptual thought is that objects, without depending on a consciousness, cannot establish their existence right within themselves. From this viewpoint, it is said that the world, all phenomena, both persons and things, is set up by conceptual. Does that jive with where people got to last week in your own minds? Yes? No? Maybe? Okay?
Can you say that one more time, then?
Okay. In the end, the meaning of the world's being established by conceptual thought is that objects, without depending on a consciousness, cannot establish their existence right within themselves. Without a consciousness, some consciousness, this cup cannot set itself up and say, I'm a cup. From this viewpoint, it is said that the world, all phenomena, both persons and things, is set up by conceptual thought, as is this water. Thank you very much. Okay, so then that takes us to question number 7. And I'm going to give you an option here because we are also studying the Prasangika Svatantrika thing in our other class. I got really fixated on this question. So the answer is kind of easy if you just go by the book. But so if you want to, the question I guess I have is, shall we delve into it or shall we go through the quiz questions and if we have time come back to more stuff on the Svatantrika? I don't know how interested people are, but I found it fascinating and ended up getting kind of stuck on it.
Let's maybe do the quiz questions. I'm fascinated by it too.
Quiz questions first and then come back to the... Any other votes?
No one online has responded yet.
I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the other 9 people in the room.
Can we cover it briefly first, though?
Yeah, we will cover it briefly because I want to answer the question. Yeah. Oh, okay.
I'm just saying about quiz...
Well, we'll get to it. We'll get to it. Okay, why don't we just go through it since it's here? Okay. Maybe I shouldn't have opened that can of worms, but I'll put everybody back in the can.
I said delve.
Delve. Thank you, Delver. Okay, what do Svatantrikas and Prasangikas mean by true existence and inherent existence? Which ones do they negate or assert? So, before you answer that question, so I want to review where these verses are coming from for each of these questions. So, to me, it's coming from verse 50 and 51. And I want to read the verses. Seeing that an effect arises from a cause, one does not claim that causality is non-existent. Having accepted conventional causality in accord with the way it arises for the world from the conceptual fabrication, ultimate causality is refuted. It would be absolutist to accept that it has not arisen from conceptual fabrication and that it is truly real just as it is. The ultimate reality, too, is not accepted, thus, not relying on the two extremes, one is liberated. I believe the answer to the questions is easier to understand than these two verses, the way it's written. my first question, too, as I came to it, is like, well, you know, why is this about the Svatantrikas? There were no such thing when Nagarjuna was writing this text. So that was Gyaltsev's. The commentator bringing this piece about the Svatantrikas in. But clearly, that kind of view about there needing to be something from the side of the object was a part of what was going on in India that he was also refuting, right? So to answer the question, back to the question, what do Svatantrikas and Prasangikas mean by true existence and inherent existence? Which ones do they negate or assert? So Prasangikas, what? Start there, in our home turf. Yes?
Online person, Heather. So Svatantrikas say nothing truly exists, but things do conventionally exist inherently because if they didn't have anything that makes them, then we could call them anything.
And Prasangikas? Yes.
Say that true existence and inherent existence are the same, and they refute both of them.
Yes. For Prasangikas, true existence and inherent existence are synonyms, and inherent existence is the object of negation, according to the Prasangika view. For the Svatantrikas, existence without being posited with true existence is existence without being posited by the force of appearing to a non-defective mind. That's their definition of true existence. And they refute true existence, but they assert conventional inherent existence. Inherent existence is, for them, is also the object to be proven according to the essentialist systems such as the Chittamatrans and the Svatantrikas. That's an interesting idea.
Inherent existence
is the object to be proven.
Yeah,
according to the Svatantrikas, Chittamatrans too. So the number of places that I looked, I have notes from Venerable Children, I have Geshe Jampa Tekchak's, has quite an extensive exposition of this in Insight into Emptiness, which was really helpful. I also spent some time in Guy's Appearance and Reality, and also some time in Jeffrey Hopkins' Meditation on Emptiness. So these comes from a little bit different places, but it answered some questions for me. Like, what really is the difference here between these guys, between these two things? Let's see. I think Heather got Venerable's quote right on the head. Right on the head. Yes. Makes them suitable for a particular label. Right. So, let's go into more detail with Tensor Jump and Take Chuck. So he gives the more kind of formal thing for selfness of the phenomena is the emptiness of existing from the side of the object's own uncommon mode of subsistence without being posited by the force of appearing to a non-defective consciousness. That's a more formal, is that right? Do I have this right? This is a more technical way of saying what we were saying before.
The meaning of true existence from the side.
Yes. So here he's explaining existing from the side of the object's own uncommon mode of subsistence. What that means is that something has its own unique way of being. It has something that makes it what it is. This phone, though it doesn't look like a phone, from its own side has this speakerphone quality that makes it what it is. Without being posited by the force of appearing to a non-defective consciousness, that part means that objects exist without appearing to and being labeled by a mind free from superficial errors. So the question I was going at is, when Svatantrikas search for the object, what do they find? They find the object. They find the telephone. This is so interesting. So that's the real difference. So this is Guy, autonomous. According to the presentation, they place great trust in the way things appear to ordinary direct perception. That's that view. Autonomous, unlike consequentialists, believe that the raw data of ordinary perception is not deceptive with regard to ultimate existence, nor is it deceived with regard to inherent existence. That our raw sense data is not deceptive with regard to ultimate existence, nor to inherent existence. So, first, with my eye consciousness, that sees a blue chair, the chair from the Svatantrika point of view, the chair, this chair, is a blue chair. This blue chair appears to be inherently existent. And it actually is inherently existent. It exists as it appears. It doesn't appear to be ultimately existent. And in fact, it is not ultimately existent. So it exists as it appears. From the first inkling of conceptual recognition, even before I think, now I'm seeing a blue chair, the chair seems to be ultimately existent, something that can set itself up without depending on the consciousness to which it appears. And that is wrong. But the sense data, they believe. So when they search for the object of negation, they search for the telephone, they find the telephone. No, not the object of negation. When they search for the object, they find the object. This is Tensor Jump and Take Chuck again. Svatantra, and in Insight into Emptiness, Svatantrikas say everything exists inherently on the conventional level because it is findable when we look for it within its basis of designation. What I still don't know is, then what is the basis of designation? It must just be the telephone. It's not, they don't have the distinction of being posited in dependence upon the basis of designation. You don't? You do?
I think I might have an answer for that perfectly frankly. Because I did find something that was, well, I don't know, kind of, it had to do with how they look at dependent arising that seemed to kind of go.
Yeah, good.
Oh, yeah, here it is. It's, well, I'll just list it out.
Yeah.
First, I'll see where this was from, one of the books you mentioned. First, they talked about the three lower schools below those ones. They talked about that dependent arising is a sign of a thing's true existence. And then they
yes.
went on to the Tantrika school. They said this is also true for Prasangika, but that the distinguishing feature of the Madhyamaka system, and it's said to be this, the Tantrika Madhyamaka's favored means of proving no existence, is their meaning of dependent arising, which was dependent on parts. So I think, and he gives the example, he says, like you were saying, things undeniably appear to the mind, well, maybe it's a little bit different, to be separate from their parts when it is thought this house has 10 rooms. The house appears to be one thing and the 10 rooms appear to be another. So basically, I think that they find the parts.
They find the parts.
Because that's the kind of...
And then it's the collection. Yes, it's the collection.
Yeah, the collection.
It's the collection.
Yeah.
Right.
The object of,
that's what they find. That's what they find.
Yeah.
Yeah, when they search within the basis of designation, that's what they find. They find parts. They find the collection. The examples are about the collection. Do you have somebody online, Scott?
No, I've got something for Vishisukha.
Oh, okay. Can people hear what Venerable Tarpa is saying? Or should we repeat it, or have her repeat it in the microphone?
It's been working out okay other nights. Please repeat.
Okay. I can't paraphrase what you just said.
Say it louder.
Say it louder.
Okay, basically, the bottom line that I can add to that is what they might find is related to how they look at dependent arising. And the background of this little piece, this was from actually from, I guess, from Precious Garland, our text. The Venerable Children is commenting on by Geshe Thetro. He talks first about this is from Meditation on Emptiness, sorry. It was about dependent arising in true existence and how the lower schools, Vaibhashikas, Sautantrikas, and Chittamatras, they're Jeffrey's talking about what is the way that they see dependent arising. And for those three schools, dependent arising is a sign of something's true existence. It's not a sign of their non-existence.
Right.
So this relates to the question. And then when you get to the Madhyamaka system, it's this thing about, instead of arising from meaning, it's arising, it's existing in reliance,
yeah,
or relative existence. And so this is the attainment of like products and non-products of their own entities in reliance on their parts. That was the basic thing. They went to dependence on parts. And so then, this was the part that I thought related to this discussion the most, that the meaning of dependent arising is a distinguishing feature of the Madhyamaka system and said to be the Svatantrika Madhyamaka's favored means of proving no existence. That's how they prove it. And they share this with the Prasangika. Masters. And so the example they give is that things appear to the mind to be separate from their parts when it's thought this house has 10 rooms. The house appears to be one thing and the 10 rooms appear to be another. And so, yeah, so basically what I was trying to just add to the discussions, what I thought they would be finding would be the parts, or you were adding to that the collection, which makes sense too. It's just this distinction. I'm not sure if it's right. It's just what I had to add.
Okay. What do you have from Geshe Sopa?
It's just a very great example.
Loud.
I think they can hear us now.
Okay.
Because they said yes.
Okay.
So for Tantricas, things aren't of true existence, but they exist by being positive through the force of hearing the non-defective awareness. To prove this, they give the example of sexual attraction.
Mm-hmm.
The desirable person possesses an element of beauty from his or her own side. Inappropriate attention exaggerates this, making the other person seem 100% beautiful absolutely no beauty from the side of the other person, they say, this wouldn't happen. There would be nothing to exaggerate.
That's what Geshe Dajo said. He explained this in the teaching we had about the teacher or the professor. Or maybe you have a president. You couldn't have a professor without there being something on the side of the person or something on the side of people that designate it.
Right. Same thing with the teacher also. Anybody could be a teacher.
Yeah.
6-year-old could be a teacher.
So there's something on the side of the person you're attracted to, and there's something on your side that's attracted.
So it's the half-half thing.
Half-half.
50% objective.
Yeah, but it has to come from the part of the person, from the side of the object.
Yeah.
Partly. Well, this is also Khenpo Jompa Tegtra. It says, so for something to exist, for the Svatantrikas, two factors are necessary. It must have some inherent existence that appears to the non-defective mind, like that. For them, if phenomena were only inherently existent, totally independent of appearing to being labeled by the mind, they would be truly existent. Right? So if there wasn't a mind conceiving and labeling, it's not their term, but then they would be truly existent, and that's what they refute. But if they existed only by being labeled, then anything could be anything, which is the point there. This, Khenpo Tegtrak says, this is the essential difference between the two systems. The Svatantrikas say that if everything were completely empty of inherent existence and merely labeled by the mind, as the Prasangikas assert, there would be no difference between imputing a snake on the aggregates of a snake and imputing a snake on a coil-striped rope. That snake and that rope are serving us again. Anything could be labeled anything because everything is merely labeled. That's their main argument. Then, maybe I should finish this up because I have a lot of stuff here. Let's see what's the bottom line. Let's cut to this. So the Prasangikas agree that the aggregates of the snake are a valid basis for imputing snake, and the coiled rope is not. Agree. But they don't agree with the reason. According to the Prasangikas, there has to be a valid basis for imputing snake, but it doesn't have to be valid from the side of the basis. In other words, we cannot say from the side of the object or basis on which we impute snake, there has to be a valid basis. This is tricky, he says. When we hear Prasangikas say there has to be a valid basis, the coiled striped rope isn't a valid basis, but the aggregates of a snake are a valid basis, we think, fine. So there does have to be something from the side of the object that makes it a valid basis. But for the Prasangikas, the fact that there has to be a valid basis does not imply that something exists from the side of the object that makes it a valid basis. When they say there has to be a valid basis of imputation, it simply means the basis independence on which we impute snake has to be able to function as a snake.
How is that not something from its own side? It functions.
It's conventionally what?
Agreed upon.
I mean, the labels are just, if this functions as a computer, we agree as a society to call this.
Nothing from the side of the computer, and it does provide the function. I mean, you can use it to compute, because we all know what that is. And how much does conditionality have to do with it? Everything, right? Causes and conditions also create, we even label the function. We label the function. Everything's labeled. Everything's back to our fundamental, conceptual fabrication.
Yeah.
But if we stick with the rope and the snake, mm-hmm. we agree this object matches the functions as the snake, and this doesn't. And what is there that makes us agree on one and not the other?
There's nothing from the side of the object that makes us agree on that.
Something there makes us agree on that one thing and not the other.
Yeah, it's all merely like, this, what do we call this, devil, poker. We just agree as a society to call this a color.
Can you speak up a little bit, Bill?
Yeah.
Just a little.
Why do we call blue blue? In this culture, we call it blue because somewhere someone said, let's call this blue. And so we all decided we'll agree, we'll call that blue. But there's nothing blue from the side of the object that's the color.
Right. I mean, when you're old, your mom says, oh, look, blue. But not because it is blue.
But is there something from its own side that differentiates it from red? We would call them both.
From the Prasangika view?
There are distinctive characteristics, but nothing inherently, no inherent characteristics.
No.
Different causes and conditions. I mean, there's a different condition that makes that, I don't know enough about light, how light and color happen, but makes that light bend in a certain way, you know.
Wavelength.
But it's the positing. We could have easily, as a culture, whenever had decided that it was red and not blue. I mean that's the positing of a label that we agree upon that brings that into existence as we know it.
And furthermore, that red could be called rouge, that red could be called crimson, that red can be called... Yeah, I mean, not just even different languages, but different shades. Right. Yeah. So there's...
But still, it makes it hard to accept that there's nothing there.
Yeah, it's hard to accept.
You're not saying there's nothing there.
Right, but nothing there that is has its own characteristics.
But we also impute their difference. We say that we conventionally agree that red is different from blue. Even its difference doesn't come from its own side.
Yeah, some animals don't see a difference in colors, but they would probably see a difference between a rope and a snake. Especially a snake.
Yeah, maybe.
So you're back to the karmic...
karmic appearance?
Appearances level of discussion.
Plus of the blood and the nectar and the water.
You know, I mean, like, we have different sensors. That's what Guy was talking about. You know, we're very... Actually, we're quite biased. I just was listening to something about how smart birds are, and we always have this common bird brain. But they can navigate much better than we can. You can take a bird and take it 3,000 miles, and it can find its way back. You take me.
No, it's not that everything is from the side of the subject.
External objects exist, but how do they exist? That's the interesting question. They assert external objects.
But they do assert that these objects are existence, you know, objects of knowledge. There's no objects that aren't objects of knowledge. That's interesting. To me, that was a big debate for about a year. Where's the rock that's 20,000 miles out in outer space that nobody knows about? And that's what that quote that he started off with kind of answers.
Yeah.
And His Holiness kind of explains that. Like, it doesn't have to be a consciousness watching it all the time. That's beyond the way he would understand that. But there must be, as Venerable Children finally told me, there must be, if there was no consciousness that ever, ever, ever knew about some little rock in outer space, you know, how could you ever know it existed? You couldn't. So it's as good as non-existent. So basically, you know, what you're talking about is another way. definition that is actually accepted from the beginning without much conversation in Buddhism, that objects of knowledge, objects are objects of knowledge, existence are objects of knowledge. They're mutually inclusive.
But are the differences between the objects that instigate us putting different labels on them or seeing them differently?
Yeah, there's difference between objects.
Sure.
Different characteristics.
There's a conventional level. You see, you're, I think you might be conflating ultimate analysis and conventional analysis.
Yeah.
Conventionally, there's red, there's blue, there's me, there's you, there's...
snakes and ropes.
Snakes and ropes. But ultimately, when you ask how do they exist, when you do ultimate analysis, you're now like, you're trying to ask, the example that Guy explained so well that made him get this finally, is like, you can't hear color. Ultimate analysis can't deal with conventionality. I mean, with it's a different thing, it's a different beast.
And when an Arya's mind is probing that question, what they find is the emptiness of that object.
And that's all they see.
All
they're realizing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that's a good way to think of it. It's these two kinds of analysis. And
yeah.
Think of it in terms of your senses. The smell exists, but you can't see it.
I'd like to come back to something that you said, and we'll talk about, and that is, typically the true existence for the autonomous is identified as something existing by way of its own unique characteristic from its own unique mode of subsistence without appearing to a non-affected awareness. But also, there is another way of talking about true existence in terms of a whole appearing separate from its parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we should just keep that in the back of our minds, that it's not just one way, but we'll bring this up again when we talk with Jeffrey about it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, in that school?
So it's two different ways of...
Yes.
Oh, so can you say that again?
Yeah, that's helpful because I hadn't, it's helpful.
Well, you had that quote.
Yeah.
Right.
Holes and holes. This is the distinction, like they only go to the level of dependence
of parts,
right.
And they don't go to the next level, which is all things are merely imputed.
Right.
We haven't hit it from that angle in our class yet.
Right.
So they would include two explanations of true existence. One, the main one, the more common one, is something truly exists if it exists by way of its own unique mode of subsistence without appearing to a non-affected awareness. But also, a whole appearing separate from its parts is another type of true existence.
Ah,
yeah.
Good. Well, that's helpful.
Good,
thank you, yes.
I had a hard time tying this together because I didn't know the ties.
Yeah, okay.
It seems important to see how they're looking at
right. Okay, so let's sum this up. This is from Venerable. Svatantrikas say conventional existence is inherently existent, is true. They don't realize the internal contradiction in their assertions. And they don't see that dependence means that things can't be truly existent with their own essence and identity, which we didn't really talk about here. They don't see that dependence means that things can't be truly existent with their own essence and identity. So it's this, and we'll get to this, I think, with the how do people refute nihilism, but that they also don't recognize that something that is dependent cannot be inherently existent, because they don't recognize that inherent existence means that things could not change, are not dependent, are not in relationship with other things.
They equate inherent existence with existence.
Yeah. Yeah, they equate inherent existence with existence. Thank you. Okay, was that helpful? Yeah, I'm in a delve. Now I want to really learn it, because I would like to be able to explain it without just reading it. But it was really helpful in answering some of the questions. Okay, and this leads actually to the analogy of the mirage. So, explain the analogy of the mirage. And again, I'm going to read these verses. It's four of them. Verse 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, five verses. A form that is viewed from afar is seen clearly by those nearby. If a mirage were actually water, why would those nearby not see it? As in the case of a mirage, those far away who view the world seem to be real, No, see it to be real just as it is. But being signless, it is not seen by those nearby. A mirage seems to be water, but it is not water, nor is it real. Likewise, the aggregates seem to be a self, but they are not a self, nor are they even real. Seeing a mirage, one might think that is water, and then go up to it. If one still grasped at the water, thinking the water isn't here, it would be quite foolish. I think stupid was the... Anyway. Likewise, it is confused to apprehend this mirage-like world as either truly existent or totally non-existent. If confused by these, one will not attain liberation. So who would like to explain the analogy of the mirage?
Heather.
Heather. Okay, Heather's on it. Go, Heather.
She just cut and paste.
All right, I think this is starting. Okay. Phenomena appear truly existent, however, if they were truly existent, we could find them upon examination quite the opposite is true. Although phenomena appear as if they are really there from their own side, the closer we examine, just like walking up to a mirage, we would see that what appeared to be there without examination while at a distance is not. Also, like the mirage, our finding that phenomena are empty doesn't make them empty. They're aware. There was never any essence there to begin with. There was never any water.
Yeah. Is she still typing?
I don't think so.
Okay. Agree? Disagree? Yes?
If things were inherently existent, then they would appear to Narayana's
Right. Right. If they would appear that way.
Which that would be the person close to them.
Right. So you get closer, as you examine more and more and more and more and more.
It should get clearer and clearer.
But as we examine more and more and more and more, it gets less and less findable.
Yeah.
Which, I meant to say this before, you know, Jeffrey, when he was here all those years ago, talked to us about how important it was to spend time making the distinction between the designated object and the basis of designation. To really start to take apart what that is. And so from this conversation around the Svatantrika view, I see how really important that is to be able to distinguish between what our sense data is telling me that this telephone is truly existent, and then what happens if I'm forced to find, well, what's the basis of designation of the label? Well, then I start finding these parts. Actually, this doesn't look like a telephone at all. But it does function as one. It's a speakerphone. It still does function as one. But it's made up of all these non-telephone parts, right? There's no telephone here. So anyway, that's the addition to that. So there was an important thing. Oh, again, Kinsir Tekchuk. They talked about the two levels of mistaken appearance, that this is what this mirage thing does. There can be two mistaken appearances in relation to one object. In the metaphor of the mirage, its appearance as water is its coarse mistaken appearance, while its appearance as truly existent is its subtle mistaken appearance. Similarly, its non-existence as it appears could be on two levels. The mirage not existing in water as it appears is the coarse level. The mirage not existing from its own side is the subtle level. When we clearly realize the coarse level of its mistaken appearance, we become closer to understanding the subtle one, which is the actual meaning of the mirage metaphor. Yeah?
We don't care so much about water.
We don't care so much about water.
We might be caring about water pretty soon.
Yeah, we might. Yeah. If a mirage were actually water, just as we've said, were actually water, as we came closer to it, we would see the water ever more clearly. But as we approach, it's not there. It depends on the combination of sunlight, asphalt, and so forth, and the appearance arose. Similarly, if we do not analyze closely, inherent existence appears. But the more we investigate, the more we discover it is not actually there. Yes. It is comfortable to us to think, oh, there has to be a valid basis, then it must exist from its own side. Once again, this is the same text. This is a great point of view. But we also have the sense, as the Prasangika state, that everything exists by depending on something else. Everything exists through relying upon things. To exist from its own side or to exist inherently would mean it does not depend on other things, but this valid basis does depend on other factors, and in that case, it can't exist from its own side. Contemplating this for a while will help dislodge the sense of it existing from its own side. Good meditation advice. What lights? Okay, anything else on this topic?
Heather wrote one more.
Yeah.
Also, like the mirage, our finding that phenomena are empty doesn't make them empty. Oh, sorry.
She already said that. But it's not that it doesn't make them empty. It makes doesn't make them non-existent. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't make them empty. They are already empty.
It doesn't make them empty. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
The finding out that the mirage wasn't water.
Got it.
Just like it says, one still grasps at the water, thinking the water isn't here.
Right. Got it. Okay.
We don't make things empty. They are empty.
Okay. Yes.
Just one point.
Yeah.
When you were quoting, I think Geshe Champa Tekcho, you said that there were two mistakes. Mm-hmm. Usually when in literature, when you hear that word mistaken, it's talking about there's a mistaken appearance of true existence. But there can be either a valid consciousness or a valid cognition in terms of the object, or it's a wrong consciousness in terms of, like, mirage. There is no water there.
Right, that's a wrong consciousness.
So it's wrong in terms of it appearing to be water. It's mistaken in terms of its appearance of true existence. That's just a subtlety that is important, I think, to note, because that's often how you find it.
Yeah. Venerable uses erroneous. So mistaken and erroneous.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Because we do complete these, I complete them. Okay, yes.
I have a question about that. So, are you saying that the self is a wrong consciousness? Seeing a self, a conventional self, is a wrong consciousness?
No. So that would be an example of you can have a valid concept, a valid conscious, a valid eye consciousness that sees a person.
Right.
That's
debatable, right? Okay.
We agree that we see.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. So if you have a valid eye consciousness that I see you, and that's valid, but it's mistaken in terms of the aspect of you appearing truly existent to me or inherently existent to me.
Okay. So the analogy isn't a direct translation to looking at the self, for instance.
This analogy of the mirage.
That the conventionally existing self?
Sure.
This aspect about the aggregates, just as the mirage appears to be water, but it's not. Similarly, the aggregates appear to be a person, although we don't.
Yeah. So it's definitely this is what it's about.
Okay.
It is it's exactly this. This whatever makes a mirage appear, all those conditions, right? And then we have the appearance of mirage. Same thing with the aggregates. We have the appearance of a inherently existent person.
But the conventional water is not there at all. The conventional person is there.
Yes. So analogies don't have to be. Analogies and examples don't have to fit exactly.
Yeah, that was my question.
They kind of get you close to an understanding, but they don't have to fit exactly.
Okay.
But as long as there is an appearance of a person, we can't discern the difference between
the inherently existent person and the, quote, conventionally existent person. That's true. It appears inherently existent no matter what.
So the inherently existent person.
It's when we grasp it that we're grasp at it that we're in trouble. Yeah.
Like the subtle aspect of the water. You said there were two levels.
Yeah, two levels.
So that would, what about at the level of there being,
a wrong
water,
consciousness
or not water is the gross, and the level of there it being
inherently
existent
is the subtle.
Is the subtle.
There's not water, but there is a self.
Yes, right.
Yeah. In the analogy, though, the false appearance of water is being equated with what would be the gross, like you're saying, but
the gross, vicious sense
is of the gross appearance of the inherent existence of the self. But it's they're not exact. When you say there's a false. There's two levels. That's the two levels of the water side of the analogy. But then it's the gross and the subtle on the other side of the analogy. It's not. He's not. He's. You wouldn't say that false. And what were the two terms?
Mistaken and erroneous.
Mistaken and erroneous are being used as examples of gross and subtle.
But every appearance we have of a phenomenon is a mistaken appearance in that it appears truly existent.
They're not mistaken in the way of seeing, of mistaking a face in a mirror for a face. It's different.
He's matching up with what Stephen said earlier, that while the mirage is an erroneous
appearance,
the person is actually
a mistaken.
It's a valid appearance.
And
the only mistake there is the appearance.
The appearance of true existence.
Right.
Yeah.
So the analogy doesn't match up.
So it's actually only the subtle. For the person.
For the person, depending. Now, how often are we grasping it? I mean, are we engaged in having in reifying that person so that we're actually having an erroneous perception of that person?
That's when there is a person.
That's different.
Talking
about appearances, not
grasping. Yeah, we are.
There's an appearance of a mirage that doesn't exist. There's an appearance of a person that does exist.
Yes.
Both of them appear inherently existent.
Right.
There's a mistaken in terms of the inherent existence.
Right.
This one, actually, it's a valid appearance.
Right.
There is a person.
But if we go to the next verse that says, and if you stand there at the water and go, there's water here, that would be stupid, right? If you stand there and grasp at the person, there's a person here, that would equally be a mis. No?
There's no carryover like that because of this discrepancy that the mirage does not, the water does not exist on the mirage.
Right.
There is a conventionally existent person,
but that's not what I'm seeing.
Right.
Because Venerable says the same thing with the snake and the rope. She says you come to different conclusions, but the thinking is the same.
Yeah. That's what.
You're saying the graspable person is not there at all.
Person that we grasp at as truly existing
right.
is not there at all. That's what I'm saying.
In verse 55, it's like somebody seeing a mirage in water and going up and not finding the water and then still grasping at the water, saying the water isn't here, rather than saying there never was water here. And that's the analogy of looking for the self, not finding it, and saying, where to go, I'm not finding it, and still thinking it exists. Is that right?
I don't know.
The next verse is 56 is the...
Likewise, it is confused to apprehend this mirage-like world as either truly existent or totally non-existent. If confused...
Yeah, that was that person's problem.
Yeah. This may relate to this. This is Guy in Appearance and Reality. Concealer truths, conventional truth, cannot be divided into real and unreal because they are all unreal or false in the sense that they appear to exist inherently, but they do not. However, they can be divided into those that are real in relation to the worldly perspective and those that lies in water and those that are unreal in relation to a worldly perspective, mirages.
So that's another distinction between the right time and consequence.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, did we make a mess, or do we actually...
Do we get here, do we get that you're settled out?
I don't know.
I don't either.
I don't either. Should we go on?
Yes.
Okay, why do some people say the Prasanga view is nihilistic, and how would you refute that?
So there's many different assertions. I'll do one.
Okay.
So a wrong view assertion would they would say, you claim that, to the Prasangikas, that you claim that things lack intrinsic or inherent existence. Then this would wipe out everything the Buddha taught, such as you experience the fruition of the karma that you yourself have done. By making this claim, you mistakenly deny karma and its effects. Therefore, you are the supreme nihilists. It is not tenable for things that lack inherent nature to function. And then the refutation, there are many. One would be, you do not claim that cause and effect. We do not claim that cause and effect are non-existent. We eliminate the propositions of existence and non-existence. We do not claim that karma and effects are non-existent. We posit or hold or assert that these, karma, effects, and so forth, lack inherent existence or intrinsic nature. Thereby we avoid the position of existence. Functions such as causes giving rise to effects are impossible in the context of intrinsic existence and are possibly only in the absence of intrinsic existence. And then there's one other that was kind of clear to me. Shantakirti, commentary on the 400 stanzas, says, we are not proponents of non-existence, for we are proponents of dependent arising. Are we proponents of real things? No. Because we are proponents only of dependent arising. What do we propound? We propound dependent arising. What is the meaning of dependent arising? It means the absence of intrinsic existence. It means the arising of effects whose nature is similar to a magician's illusion, a mirage, a reflection, a phantom, an emanation, or a dream. It means emptiness and selflessness.
Wow, where'd you get that? That's great.
That's from the 400 stanzas that we did.
No, it's from the Lam Rim Shimo.
Beautiful. Yay, Chandrakirti.
Dependent arising.
So, effects. That we didn't talk about that being a... Say that line again about label and effects.
It means the absence of intrinsic existence. It means the arising of effects whose nature is similar to a magician's illusion, a mirage, a reflection, a phantom, an emanation, or a dream. It means emptiness and selflessness.
That's the snake.
It seems like anybody that's saying that the Prasangikas are nihilists are mistaking inherent existence and existence, and mostly because they don't understand dependent arising in the same way.
Yeah. To the level of subtlety.
Yeah.
What else? Who else has got a...
There has something?
Yeah.
Refutation. The Prasangikas assert a third choice between existing inherently and not existing at all. That things, while not existing inherently, do exist conventionally, by being merely designated.
Yeah, that's the refutation. Yes.
The question about how would you refute that was interesting to me in the sense of you could refute it for yourself by everything we've said, but for the person who's making the claim, I think you'd have to actually work within their belief system and show them the consequences that don't work in their belief system so that they actually can get around to the point where they might be able to come around. They'd have to see how their system doesn't work.
Yeah.
Work within their
Yeah, I got quite stumped on this for that very reason. It's like, well, why would they buy this argument? But this, you're right.
Well, this is what Dharmakirti teaches.
Right, you're totally right.
The whole thing on this about how to understand it for yourself.
Uh-huh.
And then how to work back, I'm not using these words, but how to give proofs for others. And you always start with their, within their system and show them what's illogical to the point that they have to actually drop what they were believing because they have, they're like stuck. There's between a rock and a hard place. There's no other choice but to drop what they were believing. And
so that's why seeing those
helps someone. That's what Dharmakirti says.
So is this right? That the absurd consequences absurd that the consequentialists they're trying to create right. are absurd to the argument from the point of view of the person that you're debating. Is that right?
Right. Within, but you're working
within their system.
Yeah.
Because you can't just come in and go, well, things are dependent in three ways. Don't you know that? Doesn't refute anything.
In a way that they can hear.
Oh.
And they're ready for. And it's beneficial for them is my addition. I'm not sure if I got to that part of it all on the text.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Well, it was in the week that I did the nihilist and absolutism. She did that beautiful teaching on the distorted view, the eight fears. She did the BBCs on those eight dangers on the Tara. And what she said, basically the same thing, is that because we are so emotionally attached to our wrong views, it's hard to hear anything different. And if you're open to hearing something different, you first have to show them the wrong consequence of their beliefs, and that if you believe this, that follows, and what follows is shown to be unacceptable.
To them.
Yeah.
If you accept this, you also have to accept that. So that begins them thinking. And that's what she said. Then you give them more syllogistic presentations, such and such is such, because such and such is such. And so before we present the correct reasonings and the correct view, you have to dismantle or dislodge the wrong reasonings that brings about the wrong view. So from the Prasangika view, you present consequences first, get people to question the wrong views, and then present the right view to get
I found something from Augustine, my notes from Jeffrey's class, which talks about reason upon reason needed to knock down vibrancy of wrong view previously held, which really goes along with what Noble sent you say. So we can hear things and we can hear, but if we are holding a wrong view, it's hard to get us to change immediately because, yeah, we have a different ways of looking at it, and you've got to really show us the consequences in many ways, like.
Yeah.
The Four Understandings does that quite a bit.
Over and over. Right.
What ridiculous things would arise, follow if that were true.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. Let me go back to, this is Jeffrey, just back to the question, why do people say the Prasangika view is nihilistic? Because I think that's an important thing to hold in mind. They say if phenomena were only designated in the sense of being unfindable among their bases of designation, they would not exist at all because the unfindable could not possibly function. So that's the argument. The unfindable could not possibly function. Yeah, and then the response, Prasangika say that they've missed the point. They miss the meaning of only designating. And then, oh yeah, this is important. Prasangika say that although this term means that the object designated is not its basis of designation, it does not imply non-functionality. So they take that apart.
That's the unique feature.
That's the unique feature, yeah.
Yeah, that even within the lack of inherent existence, even an out of inherent existence, functionality, object,
see if there's anything else here. Much more, but... Well, and Venerable said, still, even though phenomena don't exist with their own independent essence, just what you said, the Prasangika Madhyagikas can present the entire system of agent, object, and action, the entire system of cause and effect, and present them all as existing conventionally without any contradiction
even while saying none of these things have their own independent essence. Okay, I have more pages on that.
What?
What? Merely, barely the.
What's that expression?
What is that expression?
Merely
designated.
Merely
designated.
Just
really
lightly. Well,
Venom
says lightly labeled.
Lightly labeled, yeah. Okay. Oh, well, two more to throw. You better hurry up. Sorry. Explain the meaning of the body not existing in the past, present, or future. It's verse 63 and 64. These next two or three questions are from that. So let's read those verses. The world does not go out of existence nor come into existence. It does not remain for even an instant. It has a nature beyond the three times. So how could it be real? Verse 64. Ultimately, the world and nirvana do not come into existence, nor do they go out of existence, nor do they remain existent. So what kind of distinction would there really be between the world and nirvana? Those two verses are the next three questions. Explain the meaning of the body not existing in the past, present, and future. Doesn't inherently exist. Okay, we've already established that. Anything else about that?
It's changing constantly.
It's changing constantly.
We say moment to moment, but we could break down the moment to a smaller particle of time.
Yeah.
If the body existed inherently, it would have to exist inherently in the past, in the present, or the future. If it existed inherently in the future, it must stay in the future. A present body could not come about. Similarly, if the body were inherently a present object, it wouldn't have a past or a future.
That's
they don't
it.
From their own side. They don't arise or abide or disintegrate from their own side. They all depend on other factors.
If the body were inherently existent, it would all already be totally formed before it existed. So it would come into existence already formed with its own entity from being a future object. So the newborn would also be the 13-year-old, the 43-year-old, the 83-year-old. If it goes out of existence totally and changed, it would still exist after it ceased.
That's absurd. That's absurd. Yeah.
I have a few verses from the treatise on the middle.
Oh, yeah, good.
Okay, so a thing itself does not change. Something different does not change. Because a young man doesn't grow old, and because an old man doesn't grow old either. If a thing itself changed, milk itself would be curd, or curd would have come to be an entity different from milk.
Huh. Is that chapter 2? Is that the coming and going?
Chapter 13, examination of compounded phenomena.
Yeah, I think it works. What Venerable was, or maybe the Kinsir Tekchak was tying this to chapter 2 about no inherently existent coming and going. And, you know, Venerable did the whole thing about walking. Mm-hmm. You know, if you sit down and look, where is the walking happening? Is it before the foot, after the foot, over the foot? But the image I had, I don't remember when Jeffrey told us the story about being a little boy on the tricycle as a small child sitting on his tricycle, wheeling himself back and forth, looking at where is the place that he had crossed over or come back, you know, trying to, where is the going? Where is the going on this tricycle? So this image of the coming going is so vivid to me of this little boy trying to figure this out and seeing that there's no... You can't find the coming or the going. Yeah, it is. It's a cool story. And just as Heather succinctly put it, actually she answered the question, we could have stopped talking, but it's good to keep looking at it from different angles. Anything else on that one?
Past, present, and future all dependent upon each other.
Yes, that's very important. Past, present, and future are all dependent on each other. And what does the world mean in these verses, in this verse?
The aggregate.
The world means the aggregates. Right. So it's the aggregates that don't go out of existence nor come into existence, that don't remain for an even an instant, that has a nature beyond the three times. Like Prince. Let's see if I have anything else here. Okay, let's go on to the next question. When inherently existent coming and going are refuted, what are we really talking about? What doesn't inherently come and go between the world and nirvana? Anybody?
Didn't we just do that?
Mm-mm. Sort of. Slightly different question. When inherently existent coming and going are refuted, what are we really talking about? What doesn't inherently come and go between the world and nirvana? Did the question come like that?
No. And the end of the question was, what does inherently come and go?
Oh, good. I pasted something else in there.
Second, what is the meaning of samsara? Yeah, the samsara was in there.
Okay.
This is a thing where we were allowed to go, I think.
What?
It's the ultimate analysis and conventional analysis. You can't ultimately say anything in a sense. It's hard to, you can't find, let's say ultimately, you can't find what came and went. That's what I would say. Unfindable. You know, kind of like conventionally speak of the aggregates coming and going. So I think of this as a question of the two truths.
Question of the two truths.
Leaning on each other.
Well, you know, I don't understand why this is so, but it says in the commentary, here the world refers to the cyclic existence. In the previous verse, the world referred to the aggregates. Here, the world refers to cyclic existence, and it's cyclic existence and nirvana in this context that don't inherently come into existence or inherently go out. On the ultimate level, it is empty in both cyclic existence and nirvana, lack inherent existence, and in this way there is no difference between them in being empty. Which takes us right to the next question. What is the meaning of samsara and nirvana are equal? They are both empty. They are both empty of inherent existence.
And they are not equal or the same conventionally.
They are not equal or the same conventionally.
We are not already in the nirvana.
But they are dependent in positive independence upon each other. They are mutually dependent. Anybody else? Yes?
Yeah, I have something that sort of answers both questions, I think. The reason cyclic existence doesn't inherently come or go would be because the world or cyclic existence doesn't appear to an Arya in meditative equipoise on emptiness, but that the world or conventionalities do appear to an ordinary being. So it doesn't go anywhere. It's not like the world goes anywhere when we reach nirvana, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our
mm-hmm.
perspective changes.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing about the world changes.
Well,
that's the butterfly that made the bomb go off in Hiroshima.
Well, the question is, like, what would change if it's all dependent on our perception? Right?
There's no inherent existence. What changes besides us?
Yeah, everything is changing all the
time.
Yeah,
but I mean, the difference between samsara and nirvana is a difference on the subjective side. It's the point of view is the thing that changes.
The mind, yeah. It has to be the mind.
Yeah.
Because the world appears to us, but doesn't appear in meditative equipoise.
Well, I just want to tell you what comes to mind. You can walk through a wall when you do the one. The other one, you're going to slam.
I would like to think that the world changes when someone achieves nirvana. That their
the external world.
The inherent
existent world.
No, but there, it's a contribution to the conditionality of all conditions. Yeah.
But they're seeing it differently.
Yeah.
That's
so,
what I'm saying. It doesn't. It's like the world doesn't go out of existence when just because someone reaches nirvana, they just see it differently.
Right. But the world would change.
I'm sorry.
Yes. The world would change. Our if you see the world as the aggregates. What happens to our aggregates? When
we're
yeah. How are the purified aggregates different from the contaminated ones?
Well, from our perspective, they're different.
It's an interesting thing to ponder.
I'm just talking from the two different perspectives.
Yeah, it's good to chew on. When I hear you say that, I think, oh, I'm going to become an arhat or I'm going to become a Buddha and the whole world is going to be exactly the same, like it's inherently existent, but now I'm out of it.
Well,
I don't think that's what you mean, but that's
but
the way
appear.
I hear it. Yeah.
The world won't appear.
When your meditative equipoise on emptiness, yes.
Then you're going to get up.
And then you're going to get up and then you're going to see.
Yeah.
They're just talking about nirvana. Not
in life. I don't know. I think that, what's his name? Ajahn Mon made a big difference. I mean, arhats make a difference, too.
Yeah.
I think we're kind of talking about on the cushion and off the cushion.
I think we're also talking about two different levels of, two things. I actually think we're talking about two different things. That you're talking about one thing and that we're hearing you in a different level. Or something. Because we also have the practice of getting up from the cushion and then, although things appear truly existent, we know that they are not, and so they're practicing appearing like illusion. Well, that's a changed world. But you're right, it's from the subjective side. It's from the subjective side.
Yeah, but your perspective impacts the world. So the world has changed too.
No,
not just to me. You're not, like, permanent, unchanging. When I change, you're going to change. Right? When we interact, if I come in and I'm an asshole, you're going to change one way. If I come in and I'm peaceful, you're going to change another way. So there's going to be, there's a relationship. It's like, the way you're saying, and this is what she's trying to say, is the way it's sounding is, everything's on the side of the subject, and that subject has no relationship with anything else. That I think is what it sounds like, and that's I don't think I can buy that one.
Just look at what Solinus has done 81 years.
Just
on this
line. Yeah, I'll find a verse that I'm thinking about.
Okay.
Yeah, cool.
And then the commentary has a. We'll close with this. The proper way to understand the equality of samsara and nirvana is to know that both of them lack inherent existence and are established conventionally in mutual dependence on each other, which we have said, but this is like saying it succinctly in a sentence. And I didn't say it clearly enough, so should I say it again or we got it? My enunciation was off. Okay. The proper way to understand the equality of samsara and nirvana is to know that both of them lack inherent existence and are established conventionally in mutual dependence on each other. I would say that's a sentence to sort of memorize and really think about how that's so.
Yeah.
But it's important to know this.
Short and long.
Yeah, it's important to understand this. Yeah, like short and long, tall and short.
I think verse 63 can be looked at as meaning a continuum also.
A continuum. I have to go back to verse 63.
It's about the world. It doesn't mention the world does not go out of existence. So everything's constantly changing. But there's a continuum, even though that what was there a moment ago is not there anymore.
Yes.
Doesn't be about subtle impermanence and understanding the continuum.
That verse.
That verse yeah. itself.
And then the next verse kind of restates it, but brings nirvana into the picture, which is more important to what you're just talking about.
If coming and going were a hair, you'd have to be able to find exactly where you are. Yes, if you looked at it that way as a continuum, or that coming and going is a constant moment of movement, unfindable, but motion, I guess, that would be a continuum. Is that what you're thinking?
Well, thinking like the world does not go out of existence, because even though it's all changed, the same that continuum of all those things are still there.
Yeah, although here the world is the aggregates. We need to think
about the commentary says that the world here refers especially
to the aggregates. So the aggregates, the aggregates.
Even our aggregates. I'm not the same as I was a moment ago.
Right.
There's a continuum there.
Right.
But yeah. The continuum isn't inherent.
It's not, because it's constantly changing.
Right. But when you say the continuum is still there, I go right to, and it's inherently existent.
Same continuum as it was a minute ago. That's just our mind. That's not what you said.
Yeah.
There's no freeze moves, yeah. That's why I don't see a moment pass by.
There isn't.
That's
the problem.
You're onto it. There isn't.
Yeah. Okay. We got through five. And we're done, I think. Anything else?
Thank you.
It was fun. May we all...
Yes,
delve. May we all delve until their delving is done, and then may we be able to help everybody else delve, and let's get on with it. Okay.
To this merit may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born or rising, grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzing Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the spiritual
teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Peerless Supreme
Spiritual Leader, Omniscient King of the Shakyas, Motherly Tara, Supreme Bestower of Longevity and Wisdom, Vast Ocean Assembly of Sources of Refuge, grant propitiousness here and now for a nectar of benefit and bliss to flow. With a clear mind of extensive learning gained from following the wondrous traditions of Tupten, the Able One's teachings, You bring clarity to masses of disciples with the light of children, the lamp of the Dharma. May your lotus feet remain unfaltering for a very long time. Through your dharmic deeds of hearing, thinking, meditating, and so on, place those who seek the liberated path in harmony through immaculate discipline. Please lead all beings to liberation with undeclining excellent qualities of scripture and insight, and establish them in a glory of eternal bliss.
May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Floor,